the last visit. Simon is one of those few philosophers of physics who keeps a dialogue with those of us who think about fundamental problems in physics that is provocative and annoying and instructive, and for many of us in this room, has been very crucial for me. And it's a great pleasure to have him here.
Thank you. Thank you. It's really an honor to be here again, and I guess I didn't do things too badly last time, or I wouldn't be. last time I was trying to get quite a mathematical tool, and this one I'll compensate. It will have very little mathematics, but I hope it'll get to some conceptual questions of interest. So background independence and the left-right distinction. This is a topic with a very long history. And I'd quite like to give you a sense of that history, because it's nice to know if we're in a situation where we've got new answers, it's nice to know what the old questions were. So let me start off with the source of all things. A lot of philosophy anyway, Leibniz. So this takes us right back to the period in the late 17th, early 18th century. According to Leibniz, the foundation of mathematics is the principle of contradiction, an identity. That is, a proposition cannot be true and false at the same time. A single principle, according to Leibniz, is sufficient to demonstrate every part of arithmetic and geometry. That is all mathematical principles. But the situation is very different when it comes to natural philosophy, by which Leibniz meant natural science. And what is needed in that context is another principle, the principle of sufficient reason, namely that nothing happens without a reason why it should be so rather than otherwise. Well, the language may be a little old-fashioned, but I think what's at issue here is really underdetermination, and whether we set out for ourselves a theoretical context in which it seems there can be no basis for one particular choice of some structure, some background, rather than another, then we are making some methodological mistakes. So Leibniz was recommending a framework of thought in which this doesn't arise. He was engaged in debate with Samuel Clarke, who was both a theologian and a natural philosopher, but I think perhaps more relevant for us is he had the ear of Isaac Newton, and Newton certainly assisted him in his correspondence with Leibniz. Clarke's response, well, it is very true, nothing is without a sufficient reason, why it is thus rather than otherwise, and therefore where there is no cause there can be no effect, but the sufficient reason is oftentimes no other than the mere will of God. So, of course, theology tended to contaminate a lot of these debates in this period, but Leibniz was rather good on this, because for him, God is also subject to reason, and the idea that God makes some arbitrary choices, not a solution for Leibniz. Okay, so let's look at one particular context in which this debate played out in the correspondence. This is an argument of Leibniz which has been very influential ever since. I think everyone has fallen under its spell at one time or another who's worked in space-time theory. So space is something absolutely uniform. This was common ground to Newton and Leibniz. Okay, let's take that as space is. And now there's a problem. Without the things placed in it, one point of space does not absolutely differ in any respect whatsoever from another point of space. Now, from hence it follows that it is impossible there should be a reason why God, preserving the same situations of bodies among themselves, should have placed them in space after one certain particular manner and not otherwise. Why everything was not placed the quite contrary way, for instance, by changing east into west. This space is nothing else but that order of relation, and there's nothing at all without bodies, but the possibility of placing them, then these two states, the one such as it now is, the other supposed to be quite the contrary way, would not at all differ from one another. Okay, now let's just illustrate this. I mean, we see clearly. Should we ask someone to turn the light off? So the idea is we have objects in space, we have relative distances among the objects, and now the point is if we translate these bodies relative to space, relative distances are all preserved unchanged. Of course, we have this feature in the background, which I should probably get rid of. So now it's clearer that we have a change without any change. And perhaps Leibniz's point is, if you imagine now that the rectangle is depicting space in itself, as opposed to matter, that these are just wholly phantasmagoria, I like to call them phantasms, that we're imagining for ourselves, creating a situation of determination. Now, an opposing view is that there's no undetermination in the situation because there's no basis by which any part of the space can be picked out. That does not imply that space is not itself a substance. But Leibniz did. And Leibniz held to a view of substance such that any substance, any part of any substance, must be it must be capable to refer to that part uniquely and determinably. And of course, as soon as one's in that situation, then you have an undetermination problem. So I think the modern response is not so much to get rid of absolute space, and of course we can move on to changing gravity to whatever, but in themselves, homogeneous structures, so-called non-rigid structures in philosophy and mathematics, that have non-trivial automorphisms, are not in themselves a problem, so long as there's no physically meaningful sense by which one can pick out one part rather than another. Okay, so this is now I suggest a summary of how we do handle symmetries in physics. For a symmetry transformation which leaves the form of the equations of motion unchanged, if F is a solution, so is the transform of that. And further, those solutions are identical. and only invariant quantities are real. Okay, so I think that's a general lesson, and I think it applies both to so-called rigid symmetries and to gauge symmetries. And in my recent work, just been systematically going through case after case, just as we're investigating or establishing or looking at whatever claimed problems there are, with the view that only invariant quantities are real. So I normally try to get some sense of whether that's common ground with my audience or not. I mean, is there anyone here who finds this problematic? I don't know why. It's been invariable for the rest of us.
What do you say to what Newton says in his Principia about two balls?
Yes.
Connected by a string,
yes,
and all the way then to space.
Yes.
He says, well, how do we know whether it's rotating or not?
Yes,
he
yes.
says, you just look at see if there's a tension in the string.
Yes.
Now, either there's a tension in the string or there isn't. Presumably that's a real, it's real,
yes.
either
yes.
a tension
yes.
or not.
Yes. Yes.
But there doesn't seem to be anything else.
Yes. It's one of the most difficult cases, but it seems to me it doesn't present problems so long as time temporal relations are real. And one's looking at relative velocities, differences between relative velocities at different times. These quantities are invariant and distinguished rotation from non rotation. And that's true even under the Newtonian group, the Ellis terminology, where you have boosts to arbitrary non-rotating frames for the arbitrary functions of the time, which is really the symmetry group of Newtonian gravity, and the one that was used by Newton. It's rather important that he had that full symmetry available, because after all, he had to apply his equations to, say, the Jupiter system, not an inertial system, but one that was in uniform acceleration. So as long as you've got non-rotation.
So you're saying there is absolute rotation?
Oh yes, and one can account for it in terms of
problematic.
And one can account for it in terms of invariant quantities. Yes.
Yeah. There's an ambiguity here. I mean, often when we write a symmetry transformation in a form like that, what we mean is that some translation or rotation is taking place with respect to some particular frame of reference. and then we do not identify.
Yes, existence. Of course.
We don't identify. Yeah. And so it's an important distinction for dynamics that there are symmetry transformations which leave the energy unfixed, which can use the Hamiltonian, but which relate physically distinct and physically identifiably distinct situations. Presumably identifiably distinct because you're leaving out part of the story that is something is being translated with respect to something else.
Sure, if that's the case, then indeed you would not expect, you would not have transformations. But the idea is that these are applied to the entire system. So these are transformations applied to the total closed system. And, well, I mean, I think there are issues in quantum theory, of course, quantization of gauge systems, which I think this does become problematic. But I think at least in the simple cases, I don't think there's a problem with this. This general claim. So translate all of the matter distributions in cosmic space-time. This does not produce a different and distinct state of affairs. Likewise, the boost of the entire matter distribution does not produce a distinct state of affairs. Take it in space, and so forth. None of these things produce distinct states of affairs, and you do not produce a change in any invariant quantity under such transformations, as long as they apply to a closed system. As soon as you've got a situation where the system isn't closed, you've got a different ballpark.
What's meant by the notion of reality? Is it connected with the notion of measurability in some way?
The claim is that all that is measurable is invariant. But this is a broader class. The invariants are going to be broader than
that. So you could have invariant quantities that may not be measurable but would still be real.
Sure. Yes, that is relative. So this seems to be more than just an operational claim or a claim of that.
What about the violation of parity?
That's what this talk is about. That's what this talk is about.
That's a real thing that it's not invariant.
That's what this talk is about.
Oh.
Okay, so let me. Oh, I'm so sorry.
Just following up on what Lee said, I don't. You asked if anyone had a problem with that. Yeah. I don't have a problem with it, but there are a lot of subtleties. And it seems easy to draw spurious conclusions from this, especially in a quantum setting. So, for example, this came up the other day in some other talk. You might conclude from it that the wave function has to be invariant under all rotations, and then you would rule out systems which contain an odd number of half integer spin particles.
Yeah.
Because it can't be invariant under rotations.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I think I take the point about subtleties. One can easily make mistakes. I hope I'm not going to do that.
I'm not saying mistakes. It takes more work to show that in fact you is tenable in a quantum setting.
Yeah. Yeah. That's right. I think ultimately it also leads to the interpretation of what you probably quite mechanics. We need to have a view, I think, on that. As things stand, I mean, if one's just going by the Copenhagen interpretation or whatever, then one never does apply quantum mechanics to all forces. Okay, but if we have this picture in place and the invariant quantities are real, let's just go back to our little collection of particles with their relative distances all invariant. Of course, we haven't actually pinned down the distribution, and we have some arbitrariness here. We need to put in an extra relative distance that pins that down. Now, we're talking about Leibniz's philosophy, so let's make them distinct substances, as Leibniz required. But still we have a problem. And we have this problem. Now, which of these two situations is, as it were, the correct one? Indeed, is this the symmetry of the system, and should we therefore be identifying it? If we go to the text, I mean, Leibniz was pretty ambiguous on this. Why everything was not placed the quite contrary way, for instance, by changing east into west, did he indeed mean a mirror symmetry or not? Well, there's textual reasons to think that Kant interpreted him as indeed talking about mirror symmetry. Kant began his career as a philosopher and natural scientist, seeking to reconcile Leibnizian Newtonian systems. But when he started to think hard about this issue of how to apply Leibniz's philosophy in the case of mirroring, and he concluded there was a real problem. So, just to read it as a parrot, from the ordinary example of the two hands, the shape of one body may be perfectly similar to the shape of the other, and the magnitudes of their extensions may be exactly equal, and yet there may remain an inner difference between the two, this consisting in the fact, namely, that the surface which encloses the one cannot possibly enclose the other. And since the surface which limits the physical space of the one body cannot serve as a boundary to limit the other, no matter how that surface be twisted and turned, it follows that the difference must be one which rests upon an inner ground. Okay, his conclusion. He said this inner ground cannot depend on the difference of the manner in which the parts of the body are combined with each other, for as we've seen from our example, everything may in this respect be exactly the same. Nevertheless, imagine that the first created thing was a human hand. That human hand would have to be either a right hand or a left hand. The action of the creative cause in producing the one would have of necessity to be different from the action of the creative cause producing the counterpart. So I think we can see this as just setting up a very straightforward obstacle to the claim that any invariant quantities are real. If we do take mirroring to the symmetry of the fundamental laws that Kant did, then how can only invariant quantities be real? A right hand will be transmapped onto a left hand. It seems that whether or not a hand is left or right-handed cannot be real. This, for Kant, is a reductio ad absurdum of any argument that leads to that conclusion. So this was his view, and now this is 1770. The real point which ended Kant's early career in philosophy, the way his whole program in philosophy, what he was trying to do. There was then followed a 12, 13-year silence in the publication of the Critique of Pure Reason, one of the most important books in philosophy in the modern period, which essentially rejects the entire Leibnizian project. Now the claim is, this is actually from 1770, but it's almost reproduced verbatim in the Critique. Thus, between solid bodies which are perfectly similar and equal but incongruent, such as the left and right hands, or spherical triangles from two opposite hemispheres, there is a difference in virtue of which it is impossible that the limits of their extension should coincide, and that in spite of the fact that in respect of everything which can be expressed by means of characteristic marks intelligible to the mind through speech, they could be substituted for one another. So it is the case that the difference between left and right can only be apprehended by certain pure intuition. And this was then generalized to cover other truths in geometry and indeed all of mathematics. Space does not have more than three dimensions, that between two points there is only one straight line, and so on and so forth. None of these things can be derived from some universal concept of space. They can only be apprehended concretely, so to speak, in space itself. Now, Kant's point here, and what was going to dominate his philosophy from this point on, is that intellectual concepts alone are inadequate to certain facts of geometry, and indeed facts of mathematics, and therefore the natural sciences. And failing pure intellectual grasp of the subject matter, what else is needed? Something sensible, intuitive, something to do with ostensive reference, something to do with what is just given in perception, but which cannot be explained as such. Okay. Now, I want to just give a slightly... I'm take issue with Kant on this. So the idea is that indeed there is nothing that cannot be understood and expressed in speech about the left-right distinction. But quite a bit of work is needed to get this right. And the first idea that, as it were, the mirror image of the world may not differ, after all, from the world. Because after all, that's the problem, isn't it? If it's true that only invariant quantities are real, mirroring is a symmetry, then the mirror image world has to be identified with the world. And a world containing a left hand must then be identified with a world containing a right hand. How can this be?
Isn't this at odds with what you were discussing before, that the symmetry should be applied to a full system?
Oh yes, I'm talking about the world as a whole.
But then the left and the right hand, shouldn't you be mirror applying your symmetry to the whole person?
Indeed. Absolutely. You'll see this happen now. Okay, let's just think about this. We have somebody, and in world FX, a solution to the equations. Somebody's looking at some feature before them. What do they see? To my right. Okay. Now, what happens in the mirror image world?
What context are we in now? Is it in Kostky space? Or
this could be space? Any classical space,
but it shouldn't be a general relativity. Do you want, because space-time curvature will change the story, then it may, in general, will distinguish one hand in this from the other.
Could we come back to that? I don't myself think that the classical general relativistic model would be any different in this respect. Are you suggesting that one can't implement a mirror image, one that can't reconstruct a mirror image world in non-flat space time?
Well, there will be a question. There may be a different world, depends on global topology of the space time, whether there's an orientation reversing different world or not. If there is, you would, of course, apply it to everything. But there would still remain the fact that the geometry as such may allow you to, using only words, distinguish right from left.
But the geometry as well would
have a lot of
and there would be a mirror.
So then the problem, I think, would arise only in the case of a manifold that doesn't admit an orientation to be a marker.
Let's see whether that's going to be relevant by the time I come to you. But look, I just want to use an argument of brute force. All of the equations are exactly the same. We start off with one solution, we look at the mirror image solution. This will incorporate the, all of the dynamics governing the person involved. So we will have the mirror image behavior of this person. Mirror image behavior of what they think, what they say. And of course, what will they say also to my right? Okay. And I've got an explanation arc up because I think that pauses for thought. Okay, the idea being now, my doppelganger in the mirror image world will have mirror image frame processes, mirror image speech patterns. The mirror image larynx will produce mirror image compression waves, and so forth. The sound will be just the same. And we can suppose that, nevertheless, there is some intuitive thought available to this mirror image person that is not available to me. Such that she understands that when she says to my right, actually she means something different from that. Okay, the suggestion is that the difference internal to the world will not be perceptible. That's the thing. Right. And here's the parallel then. The positions in space go over to relative distances, invariant under translations. And the left and right designations of objects as being left-handed or right-handed, the relevant, what that goes over to is congruence or anti-congruence, which are also invariant under reflections. Okay. So the suggestion is that all is that is an issue in our understanding, our grasp, our perception of objects as handed in one way rather than another, is congruence and anti-congruence relations between handed bodies. And one thing more, I need to get onto that, which is going to be involved with the matter of speech. But let me just, I don't know how prepared people are to go along with this, but the idea that mathematically we have a grasp of the orientation of the body, say left-handed rather than right-handed, you can see that there must be something wrong with that if we just think about the Möbius strip or any non-orientable space. Where we had some body and we imagine it's transported around the space. Now, if we transport ourselves with it, at what point does it cease to have the appearance of being handed in one sense and acquire the appearance of being handed in the other? It seems there can't be any such point. So the very idea that there must be some intrinsic character property of a shape, a handed shape, which makes it left-handed rather than right-handed, I think runs into difficulties in non-oriental spaces. I think one can make similar arguments, and people have, that what if the body is immersed in a high-dimensional manifold and if you rotate it in a high-dimensional manifold into its mirror image, and how therefore can it have intrinsically a left orientation rather than a right orientation? Okay, so this is the suggestion. What we understand about orientation is that an object is handed or not handed. That's not problematic. That it is congruent or anti-congruent to another, neither is that problem. And what I mean by that, for example, is that I can get you to draw in front of you a figure, which, let's take the F. You will either draw that or you will draw that. I can't get you to draw one rather than the other, but I can get you to draw one of them, okay, without using words like F or F. And once I have got you to draw one of them, whichever it is, I can get you to draw the oppositely oriented one. Or I can get you to draw the same oriented one. None of those things are problematic. So that's what I mean. These are things that are entirely intellectually clear. No intuition, none of this something else, something unexplained or mysterious. But here's the further thing. Certain handed objects like hands, screws, clocks, cars are called right or left or standard rather than something else. Okay, so in other words, we just habitually recognize certain objects, certain shapes as being left handed, not by virtue of any geometric characteristic that they have, but either because they satisfy some congruence relation or anti-congruence relation to something that I already know what to call, left or right. Or perhaps it's just, as it were, my prototype of what leftness is, what rightness is. And it could work like this. I mean, it could be come down to, and I think everyone's familiar with this, isn't it? Just how hard it is to learn the left-right distinction. I mean, we all just still make mistakes occasionally, and even young children. It's extremely difficult for people to grasp the left-right distinction. And in part it's because we're not giving the right sorts of cues as to what is to be recognized. If anything like this account is right, anyway. The point being, it is not a geometrical problem. So one shouldn't be asking people to attend to this left hand in order to understand what is a left hand. You should say something like, what is the hand to write with? What is the hand
In case I hear that the word for right is the hand for eating. Which in that sense, everyone by convention uses the same thing.
That's what they do with the other.
Okay, so that is a suggestion, and it's one that was taken up. The first person that I know to have taken it up, virtually the only person, apart from myself and my student, I suppose, John Ehrman has said, hinted at this, although he hasn't clearly come out in favor of it. He was. Okay, according to Leibniz, it would have made no difference if God had created a right hand first rather than a left one. One must follow the world's creation a step further before the difference can appear. Had God, rather than making first a left and then a right hand, started with a right hand and then formed another right hand, he would have changed the plan of the universe, not in the first, but in the second act, in bringing forth a hand that is equally rather than oppositely oriented to the first created specimen. Okay. So I hope all of that makes sense. Right? Of course, it's all predicated on mirroring being a symmetry. Weyl wrote this in the early 50s. I think he died in 56? I think so. It was just before apparent violation was discovered. So we don't have any comment from him on what to think about apparent violation. Before going on to that, let me just make a comment on mathematics and handling symmetries. Again, we see something very similar to what goes on in physics. Representations are identified, mathematical structures defined up to isomorphism. Left and right, in particular, again, this is something people may disagree on. I ask mathematicians when I meet them. So far, no one has argued to the contrary that left and right, mathematically, cannot be distinguished from one another. don't know if anyone here has a different view. So there's no way of characterizing a left-handed system of coordinates, for example, as such, rather than a right-handed system of coordinates. Another important example is I and minus I. So you can construct any elaborate theory you like in complex analysis, holomorphic functions, and so forth, some complex structure in twister theory, call it what you want. You could have done exactly the same things, starting off with essentially the complex conjugation of the entire structure. And that would have given you a mathematical structure which is intrinsically indistinguishable. What about time inversion? T goes to minus T. So this is not an automorphism of real numbers. T minus T squared is not invariant. So in a certain sense, I think the right thing to say here is that PC and T symmetries are mathematically not on a par. Now, of course, we can look at the time reversal business as similar. And the way to do it is to view it as a manifold, a one-dimensional manifold, and one then putting an orientation on a one-dimensional manifold. And that, I think, would be in exactly the same ballpark as placing an orientation on two, three, whatever, higher-dimensional manifolds. But you don't have to do that. You don't have to model a time evolution in physics in that way. In particular, if equations are exploiting the field properties of the real numbers, then you will not have this automorphism. It becomes mathematically possible to express a forward direction in time rather than a backward direction in time in a purely intrinsic sense. And that's the suggestion.
I guess I don't understand this point so clearly t minus t squared is not invariant under t to minus t, but in some sense, by defining t minus t squared, you've already defined the direction of time. And in the same way, you could mathematically, given orientation, you can define functions that depend on orientation.
The claim here is that I can express the fact that a real number is positive rather than negative, or that the difference between two real numbers is positive rather than negative. I can do that purely intrinsically. Now, are you saying something similar can be done in the case of orientation to field energy?
Well, no. I guess what I'm saying is that that when you define multiplication, you are accusing positive versus negative in some sense.
You're right. Multiplication is what breaks the symmetry. If we were just looking at the absolute group of real numbers, we would not have this. We would not be able to characterize the positives as distinct from the negatives. But multiplication of numbers is a part of the real number field, and this is a part of what makes it a field of numbers. There's nothing comparable in the case of orientation.
Well, you do multiply poles and functions together. The thing you're mixing up T with what it really is. Here it's really a function on your one-dimensional manifold. You can show them that function. You can obviously write down invariant functions, non-invariant functions.
Yes, I agree. If the issue is one has a one-dimensional manifold and one orientation to place a point, then yes, I think we're in the same ballpark. A spatial representation, yes. The point is one doesn't have to represent time in that way.
Perhaps what you're saying is, in fact, not the other way around. I think the point about time is that we do think of it very much as an additive group, whereas we don't think of space, any one direction of space, as so much in this group structure. Because time defines time evolution, we tend very much to think of it as R, and in which case T goes to minus T, that should have a additive relation. That's the absolute group coming in, minus T. Is that why you're singling it out?
Well, I'm not so much concerned with saying just how physics does treat time is really what a mathematician might make of inversion of real numbers as being something that mathematically can be characterized. Now, whether physics wishes to use that or not, I mean, I think typically physics doesn't fix upon time as something more like an absolute good. and then we're in the same ballpark as we are with finished space.
Is the notion of oriented manifold relevant here? Are you granting that that's a valid mathematical notion? Or are you ultimately trying to do away with it because of anything?
I'm actually going to end up being carefully agnostic about whether you can, even mathematically, talk about an orientation of one, the one orientation rather than the opposite orientation. I don't know what to say about that. And part of my claim is that it ceases to be a matter of physics. And this is what actually makes sense of comparative ideation, why we don't have to have a choice of intrinsic characterization of the left level. It'll come out towards this. But let's go on to parity validation. Okay, so it's in 56, 57. Creates a huge stone of time. Here's Rabbi. There are a complete threat of the structures being shattered at the base, and we're not sure how the pieces will be put together. And Pauli, now after the first shock is over, I begin to collect myself. So it very much came as a shock, as a surprise. Here's Dyson talking about the Li and Yang paper, which really led to the experiments that showed parity violation. This is the paper that examined evidence for experimental evidence that parity was conserved in weak contraction physics. And Dyson says, a copy of it was sent to me and I read it twice. I said, this is very interesting, but I had not the imagination to say, by golly, if this is true, it opens up a whole new branch of physics. I think other physicists, with very few exceptions at that time, were as unimaginative as I am. Very honest man, Dyson. Okay, so here's an example of a parity violating experiment. This is by Crawford et al. So we have the pion. It's actually been scattered off a proton, but I've left that off. It decays into a lambda hyperon, and the kaon, the lambda hyperon, in turn decays into a pion and another proton. Okay. Now, I'm going to use toy mathematics really rather than go through any of the equations of electric theory. I mean, ultimately, well, I'll say this somewhere. So I just here have got a cross product of two vectors, dot product with the momentum for the pion. Now, if that's greater than zero, this is the side at which the pion is preferentially emitted from the outer plane. Where the other way round, then we would say this dot product, since this is a scalar, will take opposite sign. So we can look upon this equation, as it were, as telling us which of the two actually preferentially takes place. Okay, and here I'm just making the point, B and A, two vectors, A cross B yields the vector C, so C dot B is greater than zero, that's shown, and if it's the other way around, it's less than zero. Okay, now let's go to, again, to our two possible worlds. The idea is that in the one world, that should be a cross there, it should be a dot. Anyway, this pseudo scalar is greater than zero, and in the other world, it's less than zero. And the idea is we are now ruling out this world as a possible world. Mirroring is not a symmetry. end of story. Okay. But there's something wrong with this picture.
You mean that?
Sorry?
You haven't said that.
Oh, you said that.
Yeah. But there's something wrong with this picture, and it concerns the way in which the cross product is defined. And how is it defined? The answer is by comparison to something like a picture, a hand rule, a left hand rule, right hand rule, or whatever. So this is what we essentially have just been doing. We're imagining using this hand rule to dictate the sense of the cross product A and B in the mirror world. Using this handle, so we've inverted A and B, use this handle now to construct the direction C, it's as shown. Okay, now if we have a vector D introduced, on the one side we have the pseudo scalar as being positive, take the merit image of this vector D, the superscalar is negative. So that's the picture. This is the way in which one imagines the equations ruling out one world, equations evading one world, violating the image world. And of course, what's wrong with it is how does a handle of this form, how does it characterize a relationship in two entirely distinct worlds? If I hold up my it's totally elementary, isn't it? But look, I hold up my hand, and I'm supposed to be characterizing a handle, a sense to the cross product. I do so with respect to this world as perfectly straightforward, transparent. How do I define the sensitive cross product thereby to the mirror image world? My hand bears no special relations to the mirror image world. This is a mirror image of the world taken as a whole. If instead, in the mirror image world, we take the mirror image hand and apply the hand rule, now we have a meaningful operational procedure, as it were, giving sense to the cross product. But what does it tell us? Well, here's I put in the two vectors D, the mirror image vectors. In the one case, apply this hand rule, pseudoscalar is positive. In this world, apply the hand rule, which is the mirror image hand, pseudoscalar is again positive. So if we define the sense orientation of something like the cross product internal to worlds, then so-called pseudoscalars do not change sign fundamentally. Okay, so they function just like scalars. Has anyone got any doubts that something like this is too crude to be relevant to what goes on in quantum field theory?
On the previous slide, the one these two were not the mirror image, these two correlations. On the previous slide?
Yeah.
The previous. Yeah, there.
Yeah, no, this was using the hand rule, the fixed hand rule, as though these two worlds were just parts of one world. That's what it's doing.
So, I mean, you can take the right one and just flip it over by rotation to get the left one. So you just rotate?
No, I can't. Now I'm taking a reflection of B and A, and I'm using this hand rule as before.
So I mean, isn't the right exactly the same as the left here? I mean, they're just far from the picture. They're not very images, right? Because I just rotate the green one in the plane of the white border there. Around like this, and I get the left one.
No, this is in there.
Oh, yeah, there you go.
Look, let me do it with inversions and not mirroring, just so you can check it again in a different way. So inversion now invert all three directions. Okay, this corresponds to mirroring plus 180 degree rotation. So I can't rotate that by 180 degrees back to this. I couldn't imagine if I take it. Okay, so now I'm inverting the green, the red, the blue, the green, red, and the blue. Here I have the D vector, and inverting the D vector. And the same, you see the same thing, that the scalar quantity is positive in both cases. So what we're suggesting is that we imagine that we can dictate the orientation, the sense of the cross product, to select one world and rule out another world. But internal to the worlds, in terms of the operation procedures that can actually be carried out inside of the worlds, the two observers will come to exactly the same conclusions. Okay. We're not able to advise this unfortunate as to which of the worlds she lives in. There's no procedure, no measurement she can make, which will tell her that she's in a mirror reverse world. Okay. And this, as it were, this gives us something observationally undetermined. We cannot possibly say which of these two worlds we're in. We have this perspective of some, in a philosophical way, for the transcendental understanding of what the cross product, the sense of the cross product, which is telling us that one world is the correct world, the other world is not, but no measurement, no operational procedure that can pick that up.
Is there anything that will do that by nature?
See, the Kaneka and Simon, you can overrule me, but as the chair, I'm thinking, because you're being interrupted a lot, and maybe it's fine, but maybe you should, you're making, in the course of making a careful argument, right. Maybe you should make
yes.
it.
Yes, yes.
And we should respond.
It might
but at least I lose the thread of the argument yeah. when. Yeah. when
Sure. Let's try to move it through. Okay. So whether you call it violation of principle of sufficient reason or underdetermination or something in an unsatisfactory about the situation. Okay, now what I think we've got are two senses of mirror symmetry, two senses of how to define orientation. One internal to worlds and the Mapuri symmetry. Okay, in that if we make a judgment of the congruence of some process, a parity violating decay process, with a hand rule, we will conclude that the same orientation, same congruence or anticongruence will hold in the mirror image world. So in some sense, it's an a priori symmetry. The alternative is external to worlds. One imagines a notion of orientation outside of worlds altogether that can apply to two distinct ones, one in the image of the other. A broken symmetry because one world is going to be picked out of the other one, ruled as unphysical. With the internal sense, we identify worlds, external we distinguish it, in both cases indistinguishable from within. Okay. And the suggestion is this notion, this transcendental notion of orientation is a mistake. Okay, and that we should rest with this internal characterization of orientation. Okay, now I need to say a bit more about how this works. And I think it's difficult just to rest with this on its own. And the kind of objection that's been made, let me give you an example of what I'm just saying, the meaningful use of the cross product. And so on, the relations within a world. But here's an opposing view that says it's not enough to characterize, say, the weak interaction, the orientation, decay processes by congruence or anticongruence with something like a human hand or a car or sugar molecule or whatever. Now, this is Nicholas Huggett, another philosopher of physics. He set up a simple model in using one dimension, two particles in one dimension. With a parity violating potential. So he does it all in the one dimensional case, and so he has a sort of narrow to space. Anyway, he says orientation should be defined in absolute terms, not just relative to some arbitrary coordinates. It's not until an arrow of space is given as the theory well defined. This arrow can tell us for two points whether that separation is positive or negative, which it is, spatially speaking, and hence give definite meaning to the Hamiltonian of the theory. And he makes the analogy that Newton's first law, constant motion, and thus the law is not defined unless some notion of affine structure is given. Now, of course, once we've observed the development of the particles, we could determine the direction of the arrow, and we could express its direction in relational terms, say by two standard objects in their order. Relationist is not faced with a descriptive problem or even an epistemological problem, but with formulating a theory of the process in suitable relational terms. And a plausible theory should not make fundamental reference to a contingent standard. So this is one sort of worry that's been advanced against the sort of point of view I'm advocating here. It's seconded by Oliver Pooley. We can introduce an orientation field to ground a local explanation of non-local symmetries. Here's the picture. You've got a very parity-validating process that takes place in one region of space. Then the same process and the process take place in another region of space. What gets the two processes to be congruent? What is there that tells the latter process which direction, which sense to decay? It's got to be the same as the earlier one. So there needs to be some local structure present which tells it to decay in the same sense. Okay, so this should be an orientation field. Okay, and Pulley's granting that we can do that, but he says, look, but it appears to involve an unavoidable commitment to the reality of differences that are unobservable in principle, the theory that it's only electrons congruent to such a field coupling to W bosons, and the theory that it's only electrons incongruent to such a field coupling to W bosons must be regarded as distinct, even though they are observationally distinguishable. So he's really setting us back into this situation, where he's saying, you've got some notion of orientation, and again, I think it's really the transcendental notion that he's thinking of. We're going to use that to find an orientation field, but now is it going to be congruent to the stellar field that does couple to the bosons, or is it going to be anti-congruent? And these are, again, observationally indistinguishable worlds. We have another violation of principle of sufficient reason. Okay, but look, I think what we've got to think a bit harder about what's involved in rejecting this external standpoint, this transcendental standpoint. And my model in this is we are, after all, reintroducing mirroring as a kind of a priori symmetry, even though it's violated in the equations of the weak interaction. The model, the example I would take is, again, take translations. In a certain sense, translations are a priori symmetries once you have a diffeomorphism covering the theory. Well, they have some structured space, some single region, and some region of space that's singled out from the point of view of curvature. So it's just impregnating the higher dimension. And one can speak then of a relative distance as being physically meaningful to some feature of space, some region, say, so, you know, you've got a black hole, something like that. Now, of course, you can drag all of these fields relative to the manifold, and thereby you still have translation symmetry. Okay. So the suggestion is what's going on in the weak interaction is something similar. We have an a priori symmetry in that whatever the mathematics of the weak interaction, we set up using a separate coordinate system, we write spinner equations, spinner fields down in the spectra. Here how this works, isn't it, that if you look at the so if you look at the Dirac equation, now what you've got in here are quantities like gamma 1 d by dx1, and so forth. Now, if you were to interchange two of those, then you're going to change the ordering of the gamma matrices. And if you look at the definition of the left-handed fields, something like this, then you interchange, say, psi 2, gamma 2, gamma 3, you're going to change the sign of gamma 5, and therefore interchange left and right spinner fields. Okay, so we're in exactly the same ballpark in quantum field theory, weak interaction physics, as using a simple cross product. We haven't gone beyond this question of what is a right-handed system of coordinates, what is a left-handed system of coordinates. Now, make a choice, construct your equations accordingly. You have a Lagrangian, you can calculate various quantities and so forth. Set up parallel to that, exactly similar mathematical structures, all of them based on the opposite choice of coordinate system, the sense of coordinate system. Now, insofar as those systems of equations contain all of the relevant physics, we have two equivalent descriptions, two isomorphic descriptions, the physics is the same in each case. How does that consist? How is that consistent with mirror symmetry being violated in one sense rather than the other? The answer is surely, it's just as here we have some structured space, some relative distance with respect to it, the whole thing can be dragged relative to the manifold. What we have in giving physical content to parity violation is a field of, and I don't have to say what orientation it is, being oppositely or same oriented, congruent or anti-congruent, to some other oriented process. So, to take what would be most convenient here is to take two chiral fields. Their relative orientation is preserved in the two systems. Or we could take one chiral field, its relative orientation relative to a chiral molecule. Say congruent. Describe that in one system of equations. Now set up the opposing system of equations. It will likewise describe the chiral field as congruent to the sugar molecule. Okay, so if that's my understanding of what's really going on with parity violation, this notion of the orientation field is involving some fundamental choice. I mean, it amounts to which of these two isomorphic mathematical structures is one going to make use of. And how are these mathematical structures now distinguished from one another? By some purely mathematical notion of the left or the right, unrelated to any handles. In each mathematical structure, you have, I mean, to be a bit fanciful about it, you will be describing left hands congruent to decay processes, meaning the left hand is the hand you don't eat fruit. And in the other system, you again describe the same congruence relation between the hand you don't eat fruit and the parity violating decay process. So what does distinguish the two systems of equations? The answer is some purely mathematical notion of the left rather than the right, which is unrelated to anything that you visualize. Now, maybe there's such a mathematical distinction, I don't know. But it seems to me that there's really no different situation from a choice of two different coordinate systems for the description of a phenomenon. And it doesn't matter which one chooses, which of the two coordinate systems one chooses. So this purely abstract notion of the mathematical left or the mathematical right in some Platonic sense, either will do. Either is sufficient to describe the congruence relations and anti-congruence relations that we see in the physical world. Okay, so I guess that's my conclusion. That the orientation field is a bit of an illusion to think that this is a substantive difference. We should identify these two models, conclude there's only a single representation. So thank you.
Questions, comments? Well, if you look at the universe expanding, then there's a narrow of time and it's determined by the decrease of entropy of the second law of thermodynamics. So there is a distinct rapid time reversal variance in the universe. I live in a real universe. So how does that fit in?
Well, I haven't discussed how to understand the violation of time symmetry. But I think something similar will apply in that what really matters is relations between arrows to time. And the idea that, this is contrary to the suggestion I was making earlier, that one could mathematically use properties of real numbers to model a dynamic.